Thank you so much. I've been so touched by those words. Thank you for that introduction. And really exhilarated by all the speeches that we've heard here just before I came up. I'd like to ask your indulgence. My first act of courage will be to remove my jacket. It is incredibly, incredibly hot. We in England like to talk about the weather a lot, so forgive me for mentioning the weather. I would also like to say that I notice in the audience and also on stage some new inducted members into the armed forces. Shanna, who's just been inducted into the Marines, her dad apparently is here, and apparently we met when he was deployed in Bosnia back in 1998. So to all the Marines, semper fi, and a nod of the head and a tribute to all the members of the other services represented here today. I would also like to thank the Dean Hammonds of Harvard College. I would like to thank all the alumni, all the faculty, all the families and friends. I would also like to thank the Harvard Crimson. Thank you, you know why. And most especially, I would like to thank the class of 2010 for inviting me here to share a few thoughts about the world that you are going to graduate into. Now, my mandate is to be humorous and also to be stimulating. Jokes, I have to tell you, are not my forte, but I am going to soldier on for a few seconds to try to get one out. At an event a few weeks ago, I heard a joke and I managed to remember it, which is why I'm going to deliver it here right now. And it goes something like this. Senator John Warner, who among many distinctions was the seventh husband of the actress Elizabeth Taylor, stood in their suite on the night of their wedding, and a growing panic rose through his body. He said to himself, he thought to himself, I know what I'm meant to be doing here next. I just have to figure out a way to make it interesting. Which is a little bit of the dilemma I find myself in right now. So let me start by saying and acknowledging the difficult world that you do graduate into. I do feel sorry when I read coming up to here in the weeks and days that have preceded this class day exercises and your commencement, the welter of welcome or unwelcome advice about the situation that you're graduating into. I don't think it's all hard and difficult and bad news out there. I think, yes, it is difficult, but there are incredible opportunities amongst all the challenges that you know so well and that you're about to face. And I would also like to say to all of you who are mourning leaving Harvard, it is like leaving a family after 4 years. It's like leaving your comfort zone. But it is only just beginning. There will be so many more barriers to crash, so many more families to join, so much more fun to be had, and so many opportunities to think, to push yourself, and to be on the cutting edge of your future and the future of your communities and your world. I want to tell you that whatever talent it is that you have, all of you who can, I hope you will take this moment to think about traveling around the world. I hope that you will either get your passports or renew your passports and think about taking this moment to perhaps take a gap year or a gap period of time to go out, not just to see the world, but to launch all your talents, your interests, your fervor, your youth in the service and in the enjoyment of what you can find out there. While it's somewhat difficult here to get the jobs of your dreams or the jobs you think you should have right now, there is so much opportunity out in the developing part of the world, in the emerging democracies, and in many of the places where I have covered and where I've been for the last 27 odd years. Whatever your talents or interests may be in the less developed part of the world, as I say, people are waiting for you. They're waiting for an army of energetic idealists like you to help build small businesses, to run schools, to teach class. If you want to be a doctor, you could start by helping or volunteering in any number of either NGOs or hospitals that desperately need people like you with your skills and your energy. If you're into the environment or environmental entrepreneurship, there are factories, there are fields, there are reforestation projects that are waiting for you as close as Haiti. It will change your lives, and it will set you on the road to your future. America, as you know, is extended and overextended all over the world, from Iraq to Afghanistan, Haiti, as I mentioned, you name it. If you travel, if you volunteer, if you take internships and entry-level jobs, you can share your unique American talents and values, and I hope that you would take the time also to learn the language of whatever country you happen to end up in, to learn the culture, to learn the politics. You know, I was just at the King Tut exhibition with my son in New York, and I learned there that the preeminent translator of hieroglyphics into a known language was an American, Charles Wilbur. The preeminent students and professors of so much that we now know about have been Americans, and Americans who have traveled and put their unique talents and abilities to work on behalf of people overseas and, in turn, people here. As I said, travel and work abroad will stand you in good stead and shape your futures. I know it's risky, and many of your parents will think I'm crazy for saying this kind of thing at this moment, but I want you to just do it, because we live in a globalized world. Everything, not just business, but health, education, everything we think about now has international tentacles and ramifications. You will never again, this generation and future generations, will never again have the luxury of just looking inwards. It might amaze you to know that many great American universities have opened campuses in the Middle East, in Asia, and in many other places around the world. There are some 3 million students around the world who attend colleges and attend campuses that are outside their own countries, that are in countries that are not their own. One of the most inspiring and important messages of the 20th century was delivered here on Commencement Day in 1947 by General and Secretary of State George C. Marshall. It was 2 years after the defeat of Nazi Germany, and he had just returned from Europe to report to his government of a Europe that still lay in ruins. He said that its survival was still at stake, that its people were facing shortages of everything, not just food, but housing, and didn't even have the money to pay for the imports that they needed to get on their way. So he used his Harvard address to propose a massive pan-European and US economic recovery plan, and what became known, as you all know, as the Marshall Plan, and indeed has just been celebrated again in Paris this week as the US unveiled the building right in the heart of Paris that was used as the European headquarters of the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe. And it wasn't just for Europe's sake, but it was also for the sake of a stable and peaceful future for America and generations who've come, one that would only be achieved by long-term US commitment. And he used his address here to galvanize US leadership. And he said that it needed not just piecemeal action, but that any US assistance in the future, quote, should provide a cure rather than a mere palliative. America's challenges remain the same today, helping to stabilize anywhere from Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Haiti, Pakistan, all the countries and places that have become so significant and important to your lives are all vital and require a long-term commitment, a coherent commitment for your peace and security as well. And beyond the armies and the treasure that the United States is deploying and spending in these places, they need armies of people like you who are graduating today, civilians who wield bright ideals, high ideals, smart ideas, who are deployed sensibly and coherently to really make development work. So how can this happen? How can you help your country? Only, I believe, if you are fully informed, fully aware, and fully on board. In 1947, Secretary of State Marshall said this about post-war Europe to his Harvard graduates. He said, "I need not tell you that the world situation is very serious. That must be apparent to all intelligent people. But," he said, "I think one difficulty is that the problem is of such enormous complexity that the very massive facts presented to the public by the press and radio make it exceedingly difficult for the man in the street to reach a clear appraisement of the situation. And furthermore," he went on, "the people of this country are distant, from the troubled areas of the earth, and it's hard for them to comprehend. That is precisely the same today. Rebuilding Europe and Japan after World War II resulted in peaceful, stable democracies that for long periods were also economic powerhouses that never threatened Europe or the United States again. But in order for your government today to adequately address Afghanistan and Haiti and Iraq and all the places that I've mentioned, to even have a shot at success, I've come to believe deeply in the strategic necessity of the people's right to know and their duty to be informed. And that's where journalism comes in, my profession, and I really hope the profession that many graduates will choose. Because I strongly believe that this can be a great and noble endeavor. It is a public trust if and when it serves the public interest. I am a true believer in the power of this profession to be a force for good. Where would the world be without a press that's uncovered injustice, corruption, inhumanity, or a press that's on the cutting edge of reform, of civil rights, of desegregation, and of all the smaller but vital issues that affect us every single day and that affect all our daily lives? A press which pursues the truth, often on pain of death. And today, ladies and gentlemen, it is regrettable, but painful death is the leading cause of the demise of journalists around the world. Murder, deliberate attempts to shut down the message and to silence the messengers. And those murders are the least investigated, and those murderers act with impunity. There is virtually no accountability. And yet, around the developing world where this phenomenon is so dangerous, it is journalists and press who are on the cutting edge of reform, who champion change, who spur on democracy, and who defend people's rights. So I believe that, as Jefferson said, a strong and robust democracy, even this one, needs a fully informed citizenry. It needs independent journalists of integrity and vigor who are not cripplingly cynical, who are committed to reporting the facts without fear nor favor, who insist on asking the rigorous questions, and who insist on holding power accountable, who never fear dissent, but at the same time are never bludgeoned into confusing dissent with disloyalty, who believe also that having this platform and this voice, this access, comes with enormous and profound responsibility. We in television have a patron saint. His name is Edward R. Murrow. And in 1958, the year I was born, he said this about what was then a newfangled invention called television. He said that this instrument can teach, it can illuminate, and yes, it can even inspire, but it can do so only to the extent that humans are determined to use it to those ends. Otherwise, it is merely wires and lights in a box. But he went on to say that there is a great and perhaps decisive battle to be fought against ignorance, intolerance, and indifference. And this weapon of television could be useful. And I believe that there is nothing more useful than television done well, and nothing more powerful. I believe also that, contrary to what many of our thought leaders tell us, Americans are and do care about the world and their place in it. Remember the amazing statistic leading up to the election of 2008, when the vast majority of Americans said that a key desire for their next president was for him to restore America's place and prestige in this world. So it's for all of those reasons that, like you today, I also am holding my breath and jumping into the unknown. Because after 27 years of loving and leaving, living and breathing CNN, I'm taping up an incredible new opportunity and also a challenge to host this week the distinguished Sunday morning news and political affairs program on ABC News. Because I will have, I hope, one extraordinary opportunity and chance to reach a larger American audience and to try simply to add to the conversation, to explore substantive issues that affect people beyond just pure politics, and also to bring a perspective on the world that I've been able to accumulate from living and working abroad and traveling around to tell people's stories. I believe so deeply in the promise and the ability of America and Americans that it does often frustrate me to see the limited discussion in so many of our public spaces and public press of the substantive issues, and, moreover, to see only such a slim sliver of the world that ever breaks through onto the airwaves here in this country. And yet, as I travel all over the world, people everywhere, from the slums of the poorest hovels to the salons of the richest places, they know everything about you, everything about your country. More than 30 years ago, when revolution rumbled across my country, Iran, when my father sadly told me it's all over and that nothing would be the same again, I was afraid. I was 20 years old, and this was my political awakening. And the Islamic revolution that shook Iran was the world's first, and it did not only shake Iran, it shook America and it shook the rest of the world, and it still is. But that forced me to suddenly become an adult in a turbulent world after a calm and privileged childhood growing up in the Shah's Iran, where we didn't do politics. I remember the violence in the streets, the martial law, the soldiers with the fixed bayonets in our face if we broke the curfew, and the protest-filled streets. I remember evenings sitting with my parents and my sisters on our porch, and we could hear the sounds from the mosque as Ayatollah Khomeini's deep voice secretly smuggled in on audio tapes. There was no internet, no blog, no Twitter, no Facebook, no global television. This was before CNN. On audio tapes into the mosque, rumbling low and determined over our neighborhood and everywhere. And overnight, the revolution turned us into strangers into our own land. We lost our home, we lost our possessions, we lost family and friends. People were jailed, people were tortured, people, including members of my family, were killed. But that loss turned into my driving force, and as I say, it catapulted me into journalism. I knew then that I wanted to be in the middle of these seismic historical movements, these global events, but as a witness, as a storyteller, to explain that what seems far away will nonetheless affect you even here, as George Marshall said to his college graduates at Harvard in 1947. After graduating from the University of Rhode Island 27 years ago, I joined CNN in its infancy, and I joined a band of pioneers. We were all college graduates, just like you, fomenting a media revolution. We were implementing Ted Turner's unique vision for the first ever 24/7 network, for the first ever global network, and for the first ever truly global village. Like many of my friends, I started at the very bottom of the career ladder. I actually arrived in Atlanta, Georgia, with $100, with a suitcase, and with my bicycle. I was assigned first to the foreign desk, the foreign assignment desk, because I was foreign. I climbed past the doubters and the naysayers, and I worked nights and came in weekends to practice and practice and plow my way up to where I wanted to be. I wanted to be roaming the world. I wanted to be telling stories. I wanted to be taking risks. And I wanted to be having fun and doing it all on someone else's dime. And it was all so exhilarating. On the road over the last two decades, my friends, my colleagues and I, we look at each other and we marvel at the sheer heart-stopping significance of all that we were privileged to witness and all the stories we were fortunate to be able to tell. And at this point, I must say, another maybe cliche, but the advantage of cliches is that they happen to be true, and we only learn that when we go out and live them, that there is no such thing as effortless success, that mastering your craft is so important, and mastery only comes with hard work. And no matter how great an education you've had or what privileges life has afforded you so far, mastery, mission, purpose, those, I think, like for me, trying to do all that were my greatest motivators. And I believe, like they were for me, trying to achieve all that, that is the greatest satisfaction, not the simple accumulation of wealth. And right now, I passionately wish for all of you to find something that sets you on fire, that fills you with a joy and a love and a commitment. And I also hope that you'll be ready when your moral courage is called upon, and it will be. And here you might say that I'd cross-checked with President Fowles, that I had cross-checked with Dean Hammonds about the patron saint, apparently, of Harvard, former U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, but I want to quote him on moral courage. When he went to South Africa, when Nelson Mandela was serving out what turned out to be a 28-year jail sentence simply for seeking justice for the majority there and justice for everybody, this is what Robert Kennedy said, that few men are willing to brave the disapproval of their fellows, the censure of their colleagues, and the wrath of their society. Moral courage, he said, is a rarer commodity than bravery in battle or great intelligence. And yet, it is the one essential vital quality for those who seek to change the world, which yields most painfully to change. And just as I discovered that journalism can really make a difference, you too can all make a difference in anything and everything that you choose. I know that you can all make your mark, and along the way, never be afraid of falling or failing. Or more to the point, never equate setbacks with failure. Because you are all high achievers and you will all take risks. But it's how you deal with adversity and how you deal with disappointment that will define you. My friend, the celebrated Iranian photographer and artist Shirin Neshat, has said that the fundamental thing about the process of being an artist, you can insert there whatever you choose to do, is failure. You have to learn to accept that you are going to fail at times, that it is similarly important for your critics, your audience, and your peers to understand that this failure is part of growth, that there's nothing wrong with failure. You fail or you fall, and then you pick yourself up again. And it is that very process that counts in the end. So as I too get set to graduate from my alma mater, CNN, to move on to ABC News to take up this extraordinary challenge, I'm sure that we all of us graduates here today, share the same sense of excitement, the same sense of promise of a brave new adventure, the same shadow of fear, trepidation, anxiety, as we now hurl ourselves out of our comfort zones. But as I started by saying, whatever you decide to do, do well for yourselves, but also do good for your families, for your friends, for your communities, and for your countries, for our shared world. As you find your voice and your worldview, find the human face, find the social face of whatever endeavor it is you put your life to. And remember that it is, in the end, all about justice, not just us. And I'll tell you where I found that. It's a slogan printed on some napkins that I bought at a fair in Vermont and that I'm constantly waving in the face of my long-suffering 10-year-old son. But think about it. Wherever I go in the world, people talk about justice, about dignity, and that is, in the end, that what really matters. So let's wish each of us, all of us, all together, each other, good luck, and vow never, ever to sit on the sidelines of life, ever. 100 years ago, the great American president, Theodore Roosevelt, went to Paris, and he spoke at the Sorbonne University to students just like you. I'm sure you all know this quote, but I'm going to say it again because I love it. I hope you do. He said that it's not the critic who counts. The credit belongs to the man and woman who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, and who strives valiantly, who errs and who comes up short again and again, who knows great enthusiasms, great devotions, and who spends himself, herself, in a worthy cause. Who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he or she fails, at least fails while daring greatly. And so that his or her place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat. I love those words. It's a call to action. I hope you do too. And I hope you have fun. I hope you enjoy your life and your work, and live in this moment, whatever it might be. Goodbye and good luck, and thank you for having me.